You are listening to the Diesel Powered Podcast, the voice of Dieselpunk, brought to you by Comic Bento. Get a mystery box of comics and graphic novels in your mailbox every month. $50 worth at least, guaranteed, for less than 20 bucks. Visit mycomicbento.com for more. Also brought to you by Audible. Get a free audiobook on us at audibletrial.com/dieselpoweredpodcast. And now, it's time for the Agent Carter Roundtable.
Hey there, all you guys and gals, you hip cats, cool kittens. It is time for the Diesel Powered Podcast, the voice of Dieselpunk. And this is the weekly Agent Carter Roundtable. And we are covering Season 2, Episode 5, The Atomic Job. I am your co-host, John Pica, the artist also known as Big Daddy Cool. Joining me through the magic of the interwebs is our New Orleans correspondent, Ken Sharkey.
Greetings and salutations.
And all the way from Memphis, Tennessee, the darling damsel of the skies, Daisy O'Dare.
What's buzzing, cousin?
And all the way from sunny Florida, the man, the myth, the legend, Charles A. Cornell.
Marvelous.
Well, guys, we are here once again to talk about Agent Carter, Episode 5, The Atomic Job. And I will say right off the bat that this episode had a completely different feel, rhythm, and attitude from the previous episode.
Yeah, it was kind of a little more, I don't know, it felt a little bit, just a little bit more comedic, you think? What do you think?
It absolutely was. It was, there was some slapstick and some buddy comedy in here, which, you know, we'll talk about it as we go through. For me, that kind of comedic element made the ending for me a complete surprise.
Oh, yeah.
But, so the atomic job. There's a lot going on in this episode, a lot of cool stuff. And, Ken, I know you always take great notes, so why don't you kind of lead us off?
Well, John, the episode opens up with a slow pan across Agent Carter's bedroom. A first major shot that we get is Charles' favorite accessory, the red sunglasses, sitting prominently on her dresser. We get a shot of Carter in bed with a sound of it's like a ghostly kind of whisper, which then starts to become more recognizable as the professor's voice. Why am I having a brain freeze?
Wilkes.
Jason Wilkes.
Thank you. who wakes her up, and she immediately draws her pistol and puts it right through his head, because he is not solid, and there is a bit of exchange, and you can tell that he's excited and he wants to show something Peggy down in the lab.
Yeah, so first of all, let's talk about Peggy's bedroom. One of my favorite sets in the show. Actually, I was going to go to their attention to detail once again, because I don't know where they found her bedspread, But I swear to you, my grandma had one just like it.
Mm-hmm.
It's also
really creepy that there is a Stark portrait apparently in every single room.
He's always watching.
Ooh, you know what, Daisy? You may have just accidentally tripped on something there.
Oh, did I?
Or did you? That had not occurred to me. But you know what? He probably does have cameras and surveillance all over the place.
He's got that technology.
Yeah.
Well, except that we've learned that his
security
is rather lacking.
Well, but I don't think he has cameras all around for security, Ken.
Oh.
You know about him and his gal pals.
And he is a filmmaker, after all. I say with air quotes. I'm just saying.
Moving right along.
Awkward silence.
Anyway, we immediately get into one of Charles' favorite aspects of this show, the retro future sci-fi, and you know the amazing fantasy stories going on, as Dr. Wilkes demonstrates to Peggy what happens with the zero matter that he's able to absorb from our dead girl's body, or the tissue sample, rather.
Yeah, and that's that. They've really built this this zero matter thing to be almost like a character in the story. You know, we're discovering things about it all the time, and I think it's very plausible. They built it up, and you know, later in the story, there's something that kind of sets me aback as a writer when it comes to plausibility. So we'll get to that later.
Well, you know what? It's interesting that you mention that, because the zero matter is almost a character with a personality at this point.
That's right.
And we see it when Wilkes absorbs it. You know, he doesn't know that that's going to happen. He's just thinking that it's reacting to him. He's, you know, he's going to show Peggy, hey, look what happens when I get close to this. And then all of a sudden it pops through the glass and into him. He becomes solid for a moment, but his eyes become that jet black. And you're not quite sure what's about to happen. You know, it's a very eerie, evil moment, I thought.
Yeah, very vampire-ish.
Yes. Yeah, that's a great way to put it. So
yeah, I mean, I think that's a mystery within a mystery here, and we're going to learn more, I think, later on when they ramp up this whole idea of being absorbed into the body, right, with Whitney.
Yeah, absolutely. And, you know, right away, it's interesting. And, you know, this is one of the things that, I don't know, too much coincidence tends to bother me a little bit. And it was awfully coincidental to me that Wilkes and Peggy and Jarvis get the exact same idea at the exact same time as Whitney Frost, and that is to go get the nuclear warheads for our SSR team to keep them out of Whitney's hands, and for Whitney to replicate the explosion that created zero matter in the first place.
Well, the part that kicks that all off, though, is that Wilkes, when he absorbs the zero matter, is able to locate the body of the woman who had been frozen in the lake. And at that same moment, that's when Whitney's like, you know, we need to go find her as well. And it's Peggy and Jarvis in the the vents as Whitney Frost and her husband walk in, you know, and Whitney Frost absorbs the dark matter from the body and says, I need an atomic bomb. That's what really kicks off the rush to get the bomb.
Oh, yeah, I'm sorry. Not to get the bomb, but to go find the body.
I'm sorry.
I jumped ahead, but you're right. But they both had the same idea at the same time, and I guess... What?
Well, it's because we kind of find out that the dark matter sort of calls to people who are infected by it. It's called to Jason, and it's called to Whitney, so, you know, they both get that idea. So that's probably what caused it.
Yeah, and doesn't he say it's talking to me now?
To that effect? So, that's exactly what it is. The dark matter talks to him, and that's the same thing Whitney says, is that it's calling her.
So I think, Charles, they might be setting up this connection between Wilkes and Whitney. You know, we thought about it a couple of episodes ago when the accident first happened, that they must be bonded in some way, and I think we're seeing that manifest through the Zero Matter, you know, connecting them and maybe even eventually connecting their thoughts.
Yeah, and I think the other thing, too, is Agent Carter is not a superhero, and she doesn't have superpowers. We've mentioned that before. But the only person that could potentially go mano a mano with Whitney is Wilkes, because he's got the same sort of makeup right now with the Zero Matter as she has. She's physical, and he's not, which is kind of awkward. I don't know how they're going to resolve that, but I can almost see him coming in later episodes here, coming to some conflict, Zero Matter to Zero Matter with her.
Yeah. So, we skipped a scene here where Sousa is sleeping on the couch at his soon-to-be fiance's house and has lost the ring. He came there to propose, and now he can't find the ring. And
he cooked her a nice dinner, was waiting on her, and it turned out she'd had to take a double shift at night.
Yeah, and I love her attitude here. She doesn't care that he lost it. To her, it's a big adventure.
This is a cute scene, but I think you have to fall. Last week we talked a lot about a lot of characters that just sort of disappeared off the landscape.
Yep.
And then all of a sudden, you know, they're coming back. And I think to some degree this whole love interest story was really put on the back burner last week. And now it's been brought back. It's sort of a reminder episode, you know, a reminder scene that says, you know, hey, these two have a relationship and they're deeply in love. At least we think that. And I'm really struggling with this whole idea of his repressed feelings for Peggy. And as we go through, you know, later on, it's expressed, because, you know, why would you propose to somebody if you had those feelings? Daisy, come on, you're a lady here. What's going on?
Well, having never been proposed to or nothing like that, I wouldn't know. But let's see. I would say, he could possibly be trying to force himself to stop having those feelings. And it just isn't working.
Well, and we know that he there's some statements made that allude to the fact that he left New York to actually get away from Peggy. And that was sort of like in the gap between season one and season two. We don't really know why he ended up there. There was no scene that said, I'm leaving for L.A. because, you know, I want to escape my attraction to Peggy. It's that, to me, again, is problematic. Why would he do that?
Yeah, I mean, it doesn't always have to revolve around the relationship. There could have been another reason for it that would be just as plausible.
Yeah, but it's brought up later that was the reason. That's the thing. I mean, the scriptwriters have kind of sowed that seed in a number of interactions so far that suggests that he wanted a fresh, quote-unquote, fresh start, which is probably getting out from underneath Jack Thompson, and also not thinking he had a shot with Peggy, that she was too good for him. He was, you know, he's this sort of semi-handicapped guy that didn't quite cut it with what he thought her beau might be, and certainly not cutting it in relation to like a Captain America boyfriend type. And so there's some illusion that he left for that reason and still harbors these feelings. But I think the scriptwriters missed an opportunity to keep that thing on the boil. It's kind of like gone cold, you know what I mean? And bringing the scene in was sort of like, oh yeah, okay, I remember her, you know, and then all of a sudden we're supposed to really ramp up the feeling of empathy over their situation.
Yeah, we hadn't seen her since the premiere.
Yeah, I'm not sure. She's flitted in and out in the early episodes, but she totally disappeared last week.
Yeah, and we talked about how there were a lot of characters that we haven't seen, especially in the last episode or two. She was one, Rose was another, and Mrs. Jarvis has been sadly absent.
I know.
That one wounds me deeply.
I love Mrs. Jarvis.
You have a soft spot for her.
I want to be a Mrs. Jarvis someday.
Oh my gosh. Redheads with green eyes? Come on. Come on. Anyway, when we move on to our next scene after they're looking for the ring, we flash to Whitney and Chadwick's bedroom, where she is sound asleep and he is wide awake, his eyes in absolute stark terror.
And she's talking in her sleep, too.
Mumbling, yeah. He gets out of bed and moves decisively to his closet, getting the idea that he has got to get the heck out of Dodge. And as soon as he grabs a couple of pieces of clothing and turns around, she's right there behind him. You know, and it's really kind of a creepy moment right there, because she says, hey, I need your help. But not in a pleading way, just a matter-of-fact way. And, you know, right off the bat there, we get the sense that he is obviously not happy with the situation.
No, he's terrified.
No. Yeah, yeah.
Though, I mean, if you're terrified and you're trying to get away, don't try and match your shirt to your jacket, gentlemen. Just grab and go.
Yeah.
So, yeah, and then we got Jarvis and Peggy breaking into the air shaft to go retrieve the body of the frozen girl. And again, this was a lot of comedy right here in just a very few short lines. When he's trying to lift her into the air shaft, and you know, they mention several times the Woody, and it's obviously a double entendre.
Oh boy.
Well, I mean, it's Stark's Woody. I mean, you know.
Yeah, you go for a ride in it.
Sure.
Or, never mind.
Or you put a body in it.
Yeah. Stop it.
Well, you know, she says you could move the Woody closer.
Uh-huh.
And what did he say in reply to that, Sharky?
I would, but I don't want to damage the paint job with your heels.
Yeah, yeah. And then she reminds him after she's in, and gosh, what a great shot of her going into that shaft, I just gotta say. I'm kind of in a mood, can you tell? Anyway,
you're always in a mood.
Yeah, yeah. She immediately pops back out and is like, hey, Jarvis, come on. You're part of the team too. What are you doing?
You're wearing your casual tie.
Yeah, yeah. And
his recreation tie.
Recreational tie, yeah.
And right at the same time, as they're going through the air shaft, they're about to drop into the room to get the body. In comes Whitney and Chadwick, and she says it wants to be let out. Open it. And,
I was expecting that gal to be alive and full of dark matter and a living weapon. I was surprised when we did not find her alive.
You know, that would have been an interesting way for them to go, but it wouldn't have served the story that they're wanting to tell.
No, but they kind of turned it around on us.
Yeah, well, you know what? And this was a moment, Charles, when I'm watching it, and Peggy is, you know, watching through the grate, and that necklace she had on was hanging down. I kept expecting that necklace to break or to drop, that medallion to drop and give everything up. And I don't know if that was just a missed opportunity or, you know, maybe that attention to detail just wasn't there like we've seen before. Or maybe that was an intentional thing to make us think that was about to happen, to build that tension.
I think it was. I think it's the latter.
Yeah. You know,
they've been, I mean, could have been totally accidental with the shoot, but you know, when you've got that angle, you know, where they're sort of horizontal, you need something that's going vertical, if you know what I mean.
Yeah.
And be able to show the depth and be able to look down through that and see the danger. So I think they did a good job with that detail. It worked, whatever they did, whether it's accidental or not.
Yeah, we're talking about it.
Yeah.
Let's see. And then Whitney absorbs the zero matter from our victim's body. And again, she has the vampiric black eyes. Chadwick, it is in absolute terror. And she just smiles and says, I need an atomic bomb.
I don't think there's a husband out there who would really like to hear that out of their wife. No.
Well,
no.
And, you know, it brings me back to the question I asked last week. And, Daisy, you weren't with us, so you didn't get to weigh in on this. I can't figure out if Chadwick really understands who his wife really is to begin with. Never mind the zero matter and her new power, which is horrifying, but I'm not sure he knows that she is the brains and the power behind Isodyne and ultimately really behind him.
You know, I'm not so sure he knows either. He always seems kind of shocked by what she does. I mean, he probably thinks that she's just, oh, she does these little experiments now and then, but he's starting to see, you know, her potential and what she's really been up to, and she is terrifying him because most men of that age couldn't imagine, you know, their wife being involved in any of that stuff, you know, not having the, not only is she an inventor, she's running companies, and she's also got connections, as we'll find out. And it's really, you know, compared to his connections, I guess he's starting to feel a little bit like he's the powerless one and he's kind of scared. So I wonder if he's going to do something maybe drastic and not very bright at some point.
Well, yeah, I don't think he's going to survive this season.
Uh-uh.
Yeah, because he, especially towards the end of this episode, he does some things that I thought, dude, you're skating on thin ice.
Yeah, I think we're going to have a Dooley moment.
Yeah.
Remember in season one.
Yeah, yeah. And, so after she declares she's going after the atomic bomb, we find out that, you know, they're back in the lab. Dr. Wilkes is briefing Jarvis and Peggy on why Whitney would want an atomic bomb and where the You know, they know that there are two warheads that are being kept by Roxxon, but it's anyone's guess where they might be. And Jarvis says, well, that's not entirely true. And we find out that Howard is, of course, Howard is involved in some corporate espionage. And they've had surveillance and spies and feet on the ground trying to infiltrate Roxxon and all of its facilities. And there's one in particular that they've never been able to get access to. And Jarvis is pretty sure that that's where these warheads are.
I found this scene to be really, really interesting, because I've mentioned this in the past, and, you know, more often than not, they kind of show Jarvis to be this, I don't want to say weak individual, but, I mean, you know, when they were up in the ventilation shaft and he started almost whimpering about it being cold and that there might be spiders because, you know, his grandmother's basement where, you know, she kept the preserves and stuff like that, you know, he had spiders, and you get the sense that, you know, he's weak, and, you know, he's kind of a scaredy cat, and then he's talking to Carter in this episode, you know, in the scene. And he's rambling. He's actually going step by step through the security measures that this complex has. And every time she's like, well, we could do this. Well, if you do that, then this will happen. Well, what if we do this? Well, if we do that, then this will happen. Well, if we dig a hole, well, then there's like 300, you know, watts of something that will kill you. And I'm left like, okay, so are you just the bumbling butler, or is there more to you? Because why would someone like Jarvis have such detailed information? We also know that, I mean, he's able to do, we saw in last week's episode, he's able to do scientific equations. He's actually working side by side with Wilkes. And again, I have these moments where it's like, Jarvis, are you this bumbling butler, or are you almost like the Marvel version of Alfred, and they're just playing up the bumbling butler to throw us completely off the scent?
Or is it partially an act?
Yeah, well, that's what I meant. Like, as the
British-born person on the panel, can I jump in? Mm-hmm. What we've got here is a stereotypical British upper-class twit. And the character Jarvis is comedic, for sure. And I'm not sure I would have played it that way if I was a scriptwriter. But the British upper-class twit always was somebody who had great education, had great knowledge of all manner of subjects, and pretended potentially to be an expert on any one given subject, real or not, but could never do the simplest things, you know, like tie shoes or, you know, whatever. And we saw that with him trying to box with the boxing dummy or do his exercises. That's the typical English upper class twit stereotype, and that's what they're trying to play Jarvis as. I don't know that they're pulling it off quite right, because the reaction that you just gave is why it's not working. We should either see somebody who has always been consistently intelligent but falters, or a clown who's cannot rise up above their what would be called in a Shakespearean play their foppishness. They're a fop. They're the court jester, right? That's the image that you get on one side, and on the other side, you see this person that has this inkling that perhaps there's more to him. One of the concerns I have is that, if you remember season one, wasn't he so adept during his with a skill he acquired during the war that he actually flew one of the fighter planes chasing.
Yeah, that's
Howard
right.
Stark into the, you know, into the city.
Well, I mean, that's it's right. And
it's such a it's it, they've not played his character right, for, and it's caused this dilemma, this conflict in our minds about who he really is.
Well, and you'll remember.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, you'll remember from season one when we first meet Jarvis. You know, I had mentioned that, hey, in the comic books, he is kind of the Alfred of the Avengers. And we get hints and just hints and clues about Jarvis when he's talking about how Howard Stark helped him rescue his wife in an operation, he called it. And they never expounded on that any further. That was all we got. But I said at the time, there's something more to this character that if he's doing extractions and special ops.
Right.
I wonder, Johnny, if we haven't got a situation here which is classic for Hollywood, where they've done some focus groups and done some post-episode surveys and said, what do you think of this Jarvis guy? And a lot of the people say, I like him when he's a comedian. And so season two has been written that way. You know what I mean? It's almost as if they've changed his character. They've changed his character from being what I would call semi-serious and witty to being a buffoon in many cases, like over the top. And it's almost as if they've gone through some focus group or some fan feedback and that said, yeah, we like his lighter side. Let's play that up. And so they have. And what they've done is they've created this character change.
Well, go ahead,
they're listening to the wrong focus group then.
I guess.
Because
I don't know what demographic they're trying to catch. Maybe it's a really younger crowd, you know, preteen, sub-teenager crowd.
But then they throw in these hints that, you know, there's the potential for more. And the other thing that just dawned on me is, as in, like, you know, your millionaire playboy who dabbles in everything but then also kind of has a secret identity, you know, that might get him in trouble at times, you would think that Stark would have someone at his side who was capable of handling himself to protect not only Jarvis but Stark. And there's even a point where Stark says to Jarvis that him and Peggy would make a great team. Why? Because I'm not seeing, if you're going through an air ventilation shaft complaining that there might be spiders, I don't want you as a partner. And
yeah,
it's so weirdly written right now.
His role as a character, as a sidekick, is to be an enabler. You know, if you think back to, I'll open the trunk and I'll give you a tranquilizer gun, problem solved, right? So he's always got the gadget or the thing or the idea. In this case, it was this idea like, you can't do this, you can't do that, you can't do something else, leading her to the conclusion, well, this is what we must do. And so he's an enabler for her to either, figure out a plan or to have a gadget that's going to help her or whatever, or rescue her in awkward situations that don't seem to be, he's always there with the car ready to pick her up and to contact Howard Stark and get him involved if they need to be. He's that connection to enable her to get things done. And so they've just sort of said, well, if we're going to have that kind of character, it's a sort of, that's all he does. He's not a hero into his own right, then we better make him funny. You know?
Well,
and that's what they've done.
And you know, you kind of look at some of the classic hero's journeys stories. There's all throughout literature, there's always the kind of the comic foil sidekick. you know, Don Quixote's poncho. C-3PO.
He's very much a C-3PO,
yeah,
isn't he?
Yeah, he really
very
is.
Very intelligent, but, you know, if he rusts up, he's done for.
Yeah, he's the Jar Jar Binks of this show.
So far. I wouldn't go that far.
Oh, yeah, I wouldn't go that far.
I love Jar Jar Binks, so let's just stop that debate right there.
Wrong focus group.
All right.
Yeah.
Ken, get him back on track, would you?
You're asking me.
But, you know, Jarvis tells him, hey, you'll kill us all, you'll kill us all, you'll kill us all. And Peggy realizes, well, there's only one way to do this then. We've got to get a key. We've got to get the key. And the guy who has the key is, what's his name? Hugh.
John Hughes.
No.
That's not John.
Oh, Hugh Jones. Isn't
Hugh
it?
Jones.
Hugh Jones.
And
ready? Are you ready?
Let's go.
Super nerd moment!
Uber geek alert!
I looked up who he was.
Okay.
And he is an actual Marvel character. He was an oil tycoon who, in the comic books, was kidnapped by Madame Hydra.
Yeah. Hmm.
Just not using him at they're using the name, which we've seen quite a bit, but they've changed the character up a bit.
Interesting. What makes that interesting to me is that at one point, Madame Mask, who Whitney Frost is destined to become,
mm-hmm.
was one of the Madame Hydras. She was the leader of Hydra for a period of time. Interesting. The plot thickens. Well, and I love the scene between Whitney and Chadwick following where she is trying to convince him to, you know, go to Hugh and get just ask him for the atomic bombs. You know, he's got them in his control, but Chadwick's company, Isodyne, built them. So technically, they belong to Whitney and Chadwick. But you see here that Chadwick is just as terrified by the council as he is his wife.
Yeah, there was also something else that I found really, really cool about this particular scene, and I have to give kudos to the makeup artists who did her crack on her head. It almost looks like they use like a latex possibly, because as she's talking and she's slightly turning her head, and if you watch the light catch it, it looks like it's moving.
Yeah, we've seen that in a couple of other scenes where you can see the zero matter moving under that scar.
But again, it's that attention to detail that we've been talking about, where even though the focus isn't on that.
Oh, I see what you're saying.
It kind of catches your eye that, and it also looks like the crack has gotten slightly bigger.
Yeah. Yeah, it certainly has.
And that's the scene where she ratchets up the danger by going into her megalomaniac moment. That her plan is to rule the world. It's not enough just to get back at people who've watched her history being developed and her against the world. Well, now she's not going to get back at them. She's going to rule them, and she says so. So that was a great moment.
And she also kind of she plays to Chadwick's politician side by saying that there would be no more future wars and no more future sickness and blah, blah. You know, she's...
Of course. She's, the megalomaniac always thinks that. Mm-hmm. One ruler. Ein Führer.
Well, yeah, and, you know, Daisy, you can chime in here, but, you know, Chadwick has had... you know, aspirations to be a senator, and she suggested a couple of episodes ago, you know, why think so small? President Chadwick. And so now he's kind of thinking along those lines that, hey, I want to be a national leader, but she's talking about global domination, and he's very uncomfortable with this.
Well, I mean, it seems kind of, well, not only does it seem kind of unreal, but you got to remember we just came out of World War II, and we all know how some other people who were going for global domination, we all know what happened to them.
That's a great point.
And the fact that he already is part of an organization that kind of behind the scenes already runs what's going on globally.
Right. And the contrast there is that, you know, she wants to make it pretty clear who's on top, where they just want to remain in the shadows and be the puppet masters. That's their style. That's more their style. And that's why they have the puppet, in this case, is Chadwick. He's running for Senate.
Yeah, you know, and Chadwick is kind of he's a confusing character to me a little bit. You know, here he is a part of this Council of Nine, but he doesn't seem to have any power of his own.
Yeah.
He is the puppet, from what I can tell.
Yeah, and he's the foil to Whitney. I mean, he's becoming the tables have turned. It's the scales have adjusted so that she's on the ascendancy.
Or
maybe that's what they want, to contrast, to make her seem more powerful and evil, because his power is diminishing and he's becoming less effective.
Well, hey, do you
go ahead?
Do you think that maybe the council knows what Whitney Frost is doing, but because of long-standing traditions, they can't have women in their club, so they have Chadwick there as a way to get to Whitney Frost? What do you think of that? I could be way off base there.
Daisy, we talked about whether Whitney was sort of like the brain power behind Aes Sedain, and you would have thought that if there was anybody that needed to be part of that council, it would have been her. This whole thing's been played out very strangely in the background. I kind of agree with you.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, Ken.
Yeah, you know what? Because you know, we're talking about how we feel that Chadwick is clueless as to who his wife really is. I would almost dare say that possibly the Council of Nine might be responsible for helping, in a roundabout way, Frost building Aes Sedain, and then almost like playing matchmaker so that the puppet is seen as running Aes Sedain, even though they know behind the scenes that she's the one who actually is the one who is the
that
genius.
That fits with their style. Mm-hmm. That fits with their style. It's almost like a red herring, you know. Johnny, you're a magician, you know. It's diverting the audience's attention from what's really happening.
Yeah, and that's really what there's two types of direction in the art of magic and illusion and deception. There's misdirection, and then there's intentional direction. And so we're seeing a little bit of both in these episodes. But that, Daisy, that's a great point, that maybe she is, the council knows that she is the brains and they need her, but they can't have her because she's a woman. They can't break that tradition. So they bring in her husband so that they have access to her resources. That's a interesting idea.
Yeah, I'll buy that.
Yeah. So so Peggy is going to go get the key from Hugh Jones. And she goes back to the SSR, and she needs some help from Sousa once again, from the disguise department. And she's going to infiltrate Hugh Jones' office.
They also get the, with a piece of apple pie, the mind...
inhibitor.
The mind inhibitor, which, if this didn't look Diesel Punk enough for you...
Oh, yeah.
I mean...
It's got to go right up there with the bug zapper, from, in my recollection.
Yeah,
One of the great gadgets of the Amazing Stories.
Yes, it looks like it came right out of the Saturday morning cereals.
It looked like it came out of a Saturday morning cereal box.
But that's why I loved it.
Yeah, I do too. I thought it was terrific.
Yeah, and
I loved all the brassy, and it lit up, and yeah.
And what it did. I mean, think about it. Yeah. It's like Zero Matter's got nothing on this thing. I mean, it doesn't have any moving parts.
It almost reminded me of the Men in Black light pen.
Right.
Mm. Yeah. Exactly.
This scene that we're talking about, that we're leading up to, it's probably what I would say is one of the funniest moments in this series so far. One of the most slapsticky.
Yeah.
Moments in the series so far, and it was fun to watch. I'm not gonna lie, it may have felt out of place, but it was a lot of fun to watch.
Well, it was a lot of fun, and this whole scene, from the moment Peggy dons the redheaded wig.
I see why it was fun to watch.
With the bangs, with the Betty Page bangs.
Yeah, the Betty Page bangs, and... You know, the whole reason she's got the memory inhibitor is because Sousa says, Peg, there's no way you can get close to Hugh Jones without him recognizing you. Yeah, and she's like, oh, don't be silly. He met me for 20 seconds. And he's like, Peg, nobody can forget you.
She's used to dealing with Stark on that.
Well, here's...
Stark always forgets the ladies.
Well, yeah. Well, I mean, can you blame him? I mean, he's got like 900. How can you keep up? But here she goes into his office. And here again, we see Haley Atwell's acting abilities, because she's playing, you know, a common Brooklyn girl from the secretary pool who's been sent up to get some files. And we get this really nice reminder of the misogynistic atmosphere in, you know, American offices and corporate structures, with Hugh Jones saying, hey, darling, what are you doing? I don't think I've ever seen you before, and I never forget a face. And, you know, very inappropriate overtures.
Rocking the ascot.
Yeah. Yeah. Oh, I loved his outfit, by the way. Big fan of ascots. But, you know, he's got that creepy, misogynistic old man thing going on.
Oh, he was creepy.
And, you know, we've talked about their attention to detail, and this is one thing, you know, Charles, that we can look back and say, well, yeah, this is an accurate depiction of, you know, the American workplace in 1946. Women were considered sexual property almost.
Yeah, apart from that, it was a great comedic scene, and it reminds you of the comedies of that era. If you think about the Bing Crosby and Bob Hope, you know, travels movies, and
yeah, the Road 2 series.
The Road 2 series and the Laurel and Hardy. You know, they always had a scene like that, something really, really goofy, and lots of innuendo and slaps, as Stacy says, slapstick. It's pretty much slapstick, especially every time he recognizes what's going on, and he gets zapped by something that came out of a cereal box. You know, I mean, that's just terrific. For me, that's great.
Yeah, it was great. Every time he realized and remembered where he had seen her before. All she remembers is her first name was Agent. You remember that? Because he's like, I don't think I caught your name, darling. And she's like, agent. And so he remembers that.
And the end of it has got to have one of the classic lines in the series where he's stumbling out of, you know, how many times was he zapped? I stopped counting.
I think 7 or 8.
Yeah.
Because she zaps him one more time just for good measure.
Just for good measure. Yeah, exactly. And he stumbles out all disheveled. His pants are undone. She's got this thing going on about trying to find the key in his clothing and ends up having to undo his belt. That was really cool. I thought that was really, really, you know, so much innuendo was what anyone could perceive they were doing. And he stumbles out of his office, says to his secretary, or she says to him, "Did you have a nice lunch?" And he looks down at his clothes and says, "I must have."
Yeah, that was a classic line.
That was terrific. I loved it.
Six times.
One
of them was when he was, the last one when he was already unconscious, and I think she did it just to, you know.
Yeah, just for spite.
Yeah.
And it was an extra long one.
Well, you know, Samberly did say that, you know, it causes brain damage, so.
Or it could, yeah.
And I, by the way, I.
Well, I was wondering why she didn't just knock him out.
Well, because yeah, he would remember.
He would remember that.
Yeah.
But I have to say, I do dig the scientist, the SSR scientist Samberly. He's sort of like our version of Q.
Yeah,
you'd be right about that.
Oh yeah, he is building the gadgets that are going to get the job done. That is for sure. And you know, he argues with Sousa that, hey, look, I took this job because you personally wanted me on your team, and you personally, Sousa, told me I would be able to get out in the field. And now is the time. I am going with you. And I really liked his character. I didn't think, you know, his character was that remarkable in the first couple of episodes. You know, he was just serving as a plot device. But now, you know, he's stepping up and he becomes an integral part of Team Carter.
Mm-hmm. And before we get to him, of course, we have our, you know, our connection on Frost's side that we meet.
Oh, that's right. Yeah. So we'll talk about that in just a minute. Daisy, you had something to add?
Well, I was just... It's okay if we can talk about that scene with the connection, because it came next, but there's another addition to the Agent Carter team that I'm really excited about in this episode.
Oh, yeah. We'll get to that in just a moment. You know, I'm on that scene. I must have. Oh, that was great. That was great. Yeah, so... Yeah, Whitney has her own connections, and apparently, what is the mob boss's name, Ken?
The mob boss's name is Joseph Manfredi.
Joseph Manfredi, and we learn just through some of the dialogue in the restaurant that Whitney was at one point involved with him, and he kind of holds a little bit of a grudge against Chadwick for stealing her from him. Although, you know, there's an uneasy truce for whatever reason. I assume it's mostly because of his feelings towards Whitney. He wants to be a good sport. But Ken, this is another one of our ultra nerd geek out moments.
Ultra nerd moment! Yes.
Uber geek warning. Uber geek warning.
I did a little research because I was like, God, Manfredi, that sounds like an important name. Let me research that. Joseph Manfredi is actually a Daredevil villain and a Hydra member known as Blackwing. But the way that these are portraying him, some believe, is a mix of Joseph Manfredi and Silvio Manfredi, also known as
Silvermane.
Who was also at one point a leader of Hydra.
Yes. The Marvel Universe's version of the Mafia. Silvermane became a cybernetic, a cyborg, ultra killing machine. And they're playing his character here very much in that classic Italian wise guy, you know. Look, I grew up in a part of Ohio where the Mafia was pretty predominant. My dad was the national secretary of the Teamsters under Jimmy Hoffa, and this is a true story. You know, I grew up with guys with the, you know, guys like No Neck Minnelli and Mickey the Mechanic, Paxos. And, you know, these guys who were mobbed up, and there was this code, and you saw it perfectly through Manfredi's mannerisms here when he saw Chadwick. There's this code in the family that when you get introduced to a group of wise guys, if the guy introducing you says, you know, this is Joe, he's a friend of mine, that's a code, and that code means when I'm around, you can't touch Joe. He's, you know, he's with me, you can't touch him, but if I'm not around, whatever, you know, all bets are off. He's not protected unless he's with me. But if someone introduces you as this is a friend of ours, it means he is off limits at all times. And so you get this look in Manfredi's eyes when he stands up and turns towards Chadwick as if to say, you're a friend of hers. While you're with her, while she's here, you're protected. But if I meet you in a dark alley, all bets are off, fella. It was a great piece of character acting right there.
Yeah, we've seen this character before. Obviously, it's a stereotype character, but he reminds me a lot of Chip Rossetti in Boardwalk Empire.
Absolutely.
And, had the same sort of psycho trigger, and we see that in this scene where he decides to take it out on one of his underlings and just, you know, pounds the living crap out of him. So he's a slick, well-dressed, apparently well-mannered guy, and then he just flips the switch and he goes Hannibal Lecter on everybody.
And he's also aware of the Council of Nine.
Yeah, he is. And he knows that Chadwick and Whitney have power. And just as, you know, Chadwick is about to say, no, 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 we ain't giving you what you want. That's when Manfredi pulls his guy over and says, he says, wait, excuse me. Hey, you, come over here. He's like, yeah, is she a good-looking woman? Yeah. And then he's like, you think I can't see? You're addressing her with your eyes. And he beats him to a pulp. We don't see the result, but we see the blood on Manfredi's hands. And we see the reaction of Chadwick, who he realizes he is in way over his head. He is completely in no position of control at this point.
So you think that was a show for Chadwick, to show Chadwick that he shouldn't be messing with them?
Partially, yes.
It felt kind of out of place, so that does make some sense.
Well, These kind of characters, that is how they are. You know, he's demonstrating to Chadwick, hey, you don't say no to me. And just to show how ruthless I can be to you, someone I despise, I'm going to beat the pulp out of one of my inner circles in front of you.
And if I was Chadwick, you know, you've got a wife who's turned into this, what is it, like...
Power-hungry monster?
Yeah, but she's like a Medusa. I mean, where Medusa turned people to stone, she'd just suck you up and turn you to black ice.
Yeah.
And now all of a sudden he's in partnership with this other guy. I wouldn't want to be him.
Yeah, you see it all across Chadwick's face. He's just like, dear God, what have I gotten into? How do I get out of this? And to your point, Daisy, yes, he used this as a demonstration, but there was some legitimate psychotic behavior right there. I mean, it was...
definitely psychotic.
Yeah, I mean, he picked that moment strategically for Chadwick, but he was really unleashing his own psychosis against one of his own men for his own gratification or release or however you want to describe it. I don't know. I'm a little bit too much in the head of those kind of characters. That kind of frightens me.
Well, we've got plenty of them. We get a hint in the preview of what's going to happen next week. It's going to be like a psychos convention.
Yeah. Oh, we're going to talk about that. That's going to be fantastic. So here we got some more comedy with Sousa practicing removing the atomic material rods, and don't worry, my hands are steady, and he drops the rod.
And Jason says, you just blew up Los Angeles.
Yeah. Yeah, it looks like, as they're describing this mission, I kept thinking to myself, this is the worst half-baked plan I've ever heard. And they've got to put together a team, and this is where Peggy says, Sousa says, I don't know who we can trust. There's no one we can trust 100%. And she's like, well, that's not true. And they immediately go back to the theatrical agency.
Yes, where Rose is violently getting rid of an auditioner who will not leave her alone. It's a guy playing a one-man band. He's got his drum and a washboard and all that. And I don't know what happens, but we see her just shove this guy against the window. And that is kind of what gets Sousa to realize that, okay, maybe Rose is okay to take along with this. At first he was thinking that she wouldn't be good enough, because she wasn't trained enough. She wasn't experienced enough, but he sees that she's tough. She's got muscle.
Well, I mean, Carter even says that, she went through the same training as she did.
Yeah, she went through the same training, but, because she was a woman, she probably didn't get the chance to see enough action.
Well,
she has that motherly look about her, so everyone probably thought, oh, she's the secretary,
Well, I love the part where she goes, I know Sousa's here, but I'm hearing Thompson.
Yeah.
Oh, you could see on Sousa's face, that was the pride was hurt. And so he was going to prove her wrong right then and there. That's when he made up his mind.
Well, and, Peggy makes the point, too, that, not only has she had all of the same training as the men upstairs, but she protects their lives every day. She is the first line of defense at the SSR.
Mm-hmm. That's true.
And we've seen her with the gun, the pistol under her desk there in the front. So she's going to get to go out in the field. And I wasn't sure how this was going to play out at first. But I loved the end result with this character.
Oh, yes. Yeah.
I mean, since season one, when we see her reach for the pistol under the console and her take a very, almost a defensive posture, even though she's sitting down at the, at the switchboard, I had wanted to see more of what she was really capable of doing.
Yeah, yeah. So now they're putting together this raid party, this team, this covert ops team. And we've got Rose, we've got Jarvis, Sousa, Agent Carter, and Mr. I like pie. Pie is good. Dr. Samberly.
I love him.
And, you know, he was bribed with this. Rose had made this pie, and that was the kind of how they bribed him into this whole thing, because apparently Rose makes a good pie as well as kick Sirius butt in his handy with a pistol.
Well, Samberly's also apparently very smitten by her, too.
Yeah, well, she's a redhead. And who wouldn't be?
That made me happy to see.
Yeah, yeah, and he basically, everybody says, hey, this is a terrible idea, you're not going with us, and this is where he says, no, I am going with you. You want to use my toys? I go along with them. You promise me field, field work, and this is it. You pick me, I'm going with you.
Well, I also like the fact that, you know, Carter's like, well, can we trust him? And it's just like, yeah, we can trust him. He's, you know, he's not in with anybody. Everybody hates him.
Yeah.
He's a geek.
Yeah, so I'm sure everybody hates Samberly, he says, yeah.
And then, of course, we have the real cool scene after that.
Yeah, yeah, we get the Untouchables, Tombstone,
Ocean's 11. Yeah.
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 Yep, the classic heist, walk down the street.
And until Samberly stumbles.
Of course he stumbles.
But I mean, it's like they're all walking out cool, calm, and collective, and you kind of see Jarvis like flicking some linen off his suit, and the song that they put in this scene,
"Pistol Packin' Mama."
Oh, such a great idea, yes, for like song right there,
mm-hmm.
and you see Samberly stumble. It's just like, oh yeah, no, this is, yep, back to reality. This is who they are.
And they stop short and kind of look around, and Jarvis is like, oh yes, I forgot to bring around the car. It was a funny moment. It was a good moment, very satisfying moment for this episode.
And the song was just right. I mean, let's not forget that was an iconic song. It was a number one song in 1943 when it came out. In 1944, It topped the charts with Bing Crosby and the Andrews Sisters. Nothing could get more diesel punk than those during that time period. To bring that back in this context was great. And the funny part about it, I was doing some research on it, and apparently Bing Crosby actually ad-libbed one of the lines in that song, and it goes, lay that thing down before it goes off and hurts somebody. So it kind of goes along with the themes that of the Woody. So,
yeah, yeah. So they are off to infiltrate Roxxon, and they get past the first line of defense with one of Samberly's toys, which seems to suck the electricity out of the electric fence and fry the guards, knock them out unconscious.
Hey, did you catch what was written on the panel truck?
Civil War Antiques.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Talk about subliminal advertising, huh?
Yeah, yeah. And Rose and Samberly play this great oddball fake married couple, husband and wife team. She does a great job. He's like kind of clueless, though.
Husband?
Yeah, I thought he was gonna blow it. I was kind of like with Sousa. They're gonna die. We're gonna die. But they pull it off and they get in. Now here's one of the things that kind of bothered me. Okay, so they talk about how fortified this complex is, but there's only three guys that they got to get past. Now, granted, didn't they talk about how, you know, armored up or heavily fortified they were personally?
Now, well, they talked about the fact that, like, they're wearing items that a normal security officer would not be able to afford. Like one gentleman's wearing Venetian leather shoes and another one's wearing Rolex.
Right. Yeah.
So these guys are not security guards.
Yeah. But you know, they talked about how heavily fortified this compound is, but they only have to get past three guys. They don't meet any other resistance.
Well, but we find out why in a little bit.
Well, why is that?
Well, because when they take the elevator down and the door opens up, another body falls inside of the elevator, which means that Frost is already there. So the heavy fortification that they probably should have met has probably already been mostly dealt with by the fact that Frost, Chadwick, and two goons are already inside the facility.
Yeah. Yeah, yep, and you know, it's a good thing they got Samberly with him, because he figures out how to open all of the door locks at once.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, they know what they're looking for. Jarvis has already isolated the potential location, and they see it again on the grid. The security system grid, the room with the reinforced walls.
Right.
And so they know exactly where they're going, which was awfully convenient.
Yeah, I thought it was a little weird that even a security grid would show double thick walls on the map. But you also brought up a point that if Jarvis already kind of knew the lay of the land, would they really need the schematic hanging on the wall for them to figure out where it is?
Yeah. It's a good point. And of course, they pick up the movement in the next hall over, and Rose smiles and says, "I'll go. I've got this." And Daisy, this was one of the finest moments of the entire series so far. Rose, with a smile on her face, mm-hmm. destroys the goons. She just took them apart.
Yes. Howdy, cowboy.
She's just completely. Oh, I was so happy for Rose. I was that just about made me start clapping and cheering in my seat, because it was about the time that we saw her. I mean, we got to see a little in season one, but this time we really got to see, you know, how tough of a lady she really can be, and she's not given that opportunity very often.
Yeah, well,
so
she's,
you know, you could see she was enjoying it a little.
Oh yeah, and you know, she has the stature that made it completely believable that she could stand toe to toe with any man.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah, because when she puts that guy's face into the wall, she's got that. Oh, let's just say it, when my wife gets that look, I'm in another room.
Yeah. Yeah. So, you know, they take care of the guards, they find the warheads, but something happens where the door locks and Jarvis is the only one inside the room. And, you know, Sousa was there to disarm the warheads and get the plutonium rods out. And they can't get in. Jarvis is going to have to do it. And Seuss is going to have to walk him through it. Now, did it occur to anybody else, though, during this exchange, it really didn't look like Jarvis needed that much guidance?
It could have been just the stress of the situation, you know, that was getting to him, you think?
Well, no, he seemed to be pretty natural at disarming bombs.
Hmm.
Well, he didn't have to do a whole lot, did he? I mean, you just had to lift the thing out. I mean, it's to me, it seemed like that old kids' game operation where if you touch the sides, it goes off. But there wasn't—he didn't disconnect any wires, or it wasn't a James Bond moment where you've got to make a decision on you know, on a life and death basis as to which wire you cut. That was happening on the outside, where you've got Samberly trying to get the door open.
Yeah.
And he does freak out when he's unscrewing the casing, and he drops the screw, and he lets out that little screech, and Sousa has to be like, yeah, it's just a screw, it's not going to hurt you.
Yeah, I mean, I think it was played out, acted out with suspense, but the actual physical activity didn't look very threatening. And I think that's your point, Johnny, right?
Yeah, you know, he just...
Very simplistic.
Sousa says it's just like taking a souffle out of the oven. Probably.
I mean, here's a missed opportunity when you think back to Series 1 when you've got all these strange weapons that they keep finding. Howard Stark's invented and been stolen, and they all have some very unique little constructions and all that. I mean, that device they had was, I mean, I don't know, maybe they ran out of money or something. The guy just went down to a hardware store, put some lights in it. It was just basically a tube with some light in it. They could have really done a number on that. That could have been more diesel punk, couldn't it?
Yeah, I get your point there. But I think they, you know, they're really trying to go for the sleeker, more simplistic elements of the sci-fi and technology, the atomic nature of it. But, you know, getting the atomic bombs, getting the plutonium rods secured is really secondary to what's about to happen. Peggy has also gone off to dispatch some more of the goons, and she hears Frost above her with Chadwick arguing that they are not leaving without her warheads. And that's when Peggy goes to confront her, knowing that she doesn't know what Whitney Frost is. And this is the scene, Charles, where you have a problem.
Yeah, I've got two problems. The first problem I have is that we know how deadly Whitney is. We've got this almost an untouchable feeling about her, that if you touch this lady and she's mad at you, bad things will happen very quickly, and those things are irreversible. And yet, when she's fighting, and I think the thing we've got to, in my mind, remember, is we're not dealing with a superhero. Agent Carter is just this ordinary agent who's got extraordinarily intelligence and able to outwit her opponents. And she's good at martial arts. I mean, we'll give her that. It's not a superpower, but she's pretty good at it. But she doesn't have the kind of amazing stories, supernatural power that the Zero Matter has imparted into Whitney. So the first problem I have, these are problems of plausibility and suspension of belief. I suspended belief when I saw how easy it was for her to kind of escape the clutches of Whitney with the Zero Matter when she's gotten her hand clamped on by Whitney. That's usually the sign of disappearing mice and people breaking up into millions of pieces of black ice. And then the next thing is she stumbles and she falls off this ledge, this scaffolding, metal scaffolding in this place they're in, the factory, hanging on by one hand. And of course, you know, classic thing of, you know, Whitney stomps on the hand and down goes Agent Carter, and she falls on what looked like some construction going on below with rebar, and this very, very high, tall rebar that went right through her. So we see, we were looking down from above, we see her fall, and she's impaled by this iron rod going right through her side, and you know, at that point, it's like, oh my God, is this the end of the series? Or did they kill off Agent Carter?
I was shocked. I had an audible gasp.
Me too. And I hurt for her for a few minutes too.
Yeah, and that was a great moment to try to figure out where, you know, what possibly could happen to get her out of that situation. And what happened next, to me, just destroyed the plausibility of what's been built up so far. Let's just recap. We've got this zero matter, right? And this zero matter does some extraordinarily strange things. And then when it does these extraordinarily strange things, you need something like, some solution in a bug zapper to go see people. And all through that whole process of building up what zero matter is all about and how you can see people and they're not really there and you can put your hands through them and they fade away into nothingness, come back and all this kind of stuff. You know what? You believe it. You believe it. They've built up the believability of this because it's extra dimensional. It's amazing stories. It's this whole science fiction golden age coming onto the screen, and they've done a great job with the special effects, the scar across Whitney's face and absorbing it into her skin and, you know, shattering people and all this other kind of stuff. And it's like, oh yeah, I believe it. Zero matter is real and I believe it. And then they destroy it by not having that deadly interaction with Agent Carter. It just seemed to be just a normal fist fight. And then she's fallen. And then we cut away to her going into Violet. They take her back to Violet, the nurse, who's Sousa's fiance, to rescue her. Now, let's think about that scene. She's walking on her own two feet. There is no iron rod jutting out from one end of her abdomen to the other. Somehow they remove that. And, you know, you think, how does that happen? I mean, did they cut it away? Did they have to lift her up 6 or 7 feet in the air to take her off there? Like, take a shish kebab off, a piece of meat off a shish kebab? How the hell did they do that? And then she miraculously heals. She hasn't bled out. I could go on all night, Johnny, about how implausible that scene was. I really did not like that. I thought, if they're going to do something weird, I can buy into weird, but that was just downright stupid.
I'll be honest with you, my problem with it is that they show her with one arm down while she's holding on with the other arm, and I think the idea was the reason why that arm was down was because that was the damaged arm, which is a continuity problem because she swung with the right hand, and which got caught, which Whitney started to do the dark matter on. And the other thing too is, from the perspective of looking straight down, there were two boxes below her. To me, what I didn't understand was why she dropped, and when she dropped, she was horizontal, where we know that she's agile, she's athletic. I mean, it was almost like I could have seen her just land on the boxes, but of course they had to do it for the suspense and everything like that. But I completely agree with you, Charles, that this whole thing they've laid her on Violet's couch. I would have expected the couch to be soaked in blood.
I would have expected her body soaked in blood.
But, you know, even when Violet lifts her blouse up to put the...
It looks cauterized. It looks like...
It almost looks healed. And it's just, I was like, huh?
Maybe I've seen too many episodes. I've seen Saving Private Ryan too many times to know what really happens, right?
Or maybe we're missing a scene. that or, had to be cut.
You know, I would have believed. I would have believed it if they'd have shown some zero matter somehow, kind of, you know, making its way up her veins and through her body. I would have believed it then, because then I would have associated somehow that her lack of ability to, you know.
Well, they did show that, out. Charles.
Not after she got hurt.
Oh, no, no. But when not Whitney grabbed her, you saw,
oh,
you
yeah,
know,
yeah.
That
but
effect.
That's the whole point. That's the whole point. It's like, okay, it didn't, she didn't kill Agent Carter with the Zero Matter. Somehow, some little bit of Zero Matter got in her. But then the Zero Matter had nothing to do with how she recovered from that accident. It disconnect all the way through. I don't know. I'm you know, Daisy, what do you think?
I thought it was really a little bit too serious of an injury to give her, especially with her sitting up and being sort of like she was just in bed with a cold by the end of the episode. You know?
Oh, yeah.
It just was just a little too... It was a little too, like I said, it was not, like you said earlier, Charles, it was not that plausible, but, you know,
unless
this
is
going to affect her for the rest of the series, which I don't know if it is.
Or if there's something we don't know. And that's,
right, or if dark matter isn't, sorry, the zero matter is involved somehow and that helped her heal somehow, I don't know, science, sci-fi.
Well,
something.
she's been the closest to the Zero Matter
other
than Wilkes and Frost. I mean, her interaction with Wilkes, maybe she has had some, you know, residual effects of it.
Maybe that's right. Maybe he has rubbed up on her like
maybe
that.
Maybe that's something that we learn about next episode. Or maybe it's just she is that darn tough.
Yeah, I just go back. I'll just make a closing comment on this thing so we can move on. But when we want to create wonder in the minds of a reader in a book or in the visual aspects of TV or in science fiction movies, we need to create believability. We don't want the person viewing it or reading about it to suspend belief for a moment. And I suspended belief not once, probably two or three times in that whole section. And there was no explanation for it that would counterbalance, you know, nothing that says, oh, don't worry, viewer, it's okay, she's got zero matter in her, or something along those lines. It was just a very straightforward accident that should have killed her. And certainly would not have allowed her to do what they did later, as we've said, walk into somebody. Why did they take her to a hospital? She'd been impaled by an iron bar. She didn't take her to somebody's house.
Well, Violet says, hey, you need to be at a hospital.
Oh, yeah, but that's the whole point. It's, she's saying what the audience is saying. Hey, why isn't she at a hospital? This is our heroine. This is the person we've been following for two seasons, and you didn't take her to a hospital?
Or doesn't the SSR have a med bay?
I don't believe any of that. And that's what I'm saying about why this episode really stung, is it suspended belief
in
that little package of activity and action that took place. And now I'm sort of like,
all right,
I want my amazing story back.
All right, but as we're talking, I'm watching that scene at Violet's house, and it occurs to me that the only reason that they bring Peggy there is to set up the next scene where Violet confronts Sousa.
Yeah, exactly.
That's the only reason it's there.
I know.
Yeah.
And that's pathetic.
It's just, no. You don't need to.
I'm not saying anymore.
Don't stab your main character for the purpose of your love triangle.
Yeah.
Just don't. Don't impale her so that your romantic subplot can progress.
Even then, and now it's my turn. Because, okay, you have Agent Sousa, who is a chief of the SSR on the West Coast. His agent is injured. Everything I see in this scene is a chief who is responsible for an agent concerned about an agent.
And yet
somehow Violet jumps to the conclusion, even though really there wasn't a lot of like, oh dear Carter, please don't die on me. I love you so. There was none of that. It was a concerned friend for another friend. It was a concerned chief for an agent, and yet we get the, you're in love with her, aren't you? And it's like, eh?
Yeah, it kind of came out of left field.
That was a bit of a leap.
Yeah, we all know it. We all know it as the viewers, but yeah, Violet shouldn't have been able to pick up on that.
He just proposed to you. Yeah. You know, it's like, come on. But I felt, as we've discussed, there were a couple of episodes in the first season that we even discussed this. There were parts that felt rushed, and this was one of those, we've got four more episodes to go, so let's rush now that there is a bitter love triangle thing with Violet and Carter and Sousa, even though we already knew there was something there, but now we have to see it played out. We're going to rush it by having Violet jump to the conclusion, even though there was no sign. And it's like, come on, guys. Come on, you guys are better writers than this. We've been praising you guys the entire season. This was sloppy. This was poorly done.
Yeah, so we really trashed it. There you go, Johnny.
Yeah, no, that's all right. That's all right. But we get some we get a little redemption, I guess, in this episode, in that we see the aftermath with Chadwick and Frost. And you know, I started off at the very beginning saying that there were some moments in this episode where Chadwick was skating on some very thin ice, and this final scene with them was one of those moments where he says, I am not going to help you anymore. I am not going to be indebted. I'm not going to the council. I'm not going to ask for them to help. You are on your own. And she takes him by the chin, lifts him into the air, and says, you will watch your tone with me.
Mm-hmm.
And he was dangerously close right then to losing his life.
Which also shows that I think that she has better control over her power now, too.
Yeah. And that's when he, in the midnight hour, she's sound asleep, or so we think. Of course, you would think he would learn his lesson already on this. He sneaks off and he calls an emergency meeting of the council because he knows they got to deal with her. And this is setting up the final confrontation, the final battles on the way. And we'll talk about the preview for next week. But the final scene we see is Peggy in Howard's bedroom. You know, getting her rest, and Dr. Wilkes fading from existence once again. The bug sprayer, Charles, has worn off, apparently.
Yeah, they've run out.
But the way he seems to fade out, it gives us a little bit more of an ominous feeling, like, hey, he's just not visible anymore, but he may not actually be there. I don't know if you guys got that sense as well.
Yeah, it seemed a lot more dramatic in the fact that he was the way that he was going. You know, it seemed a lot more important than just, oh, you're not gonna be able to see me.
Well, and right before that, he was talking about the place where dark matter comes from, where zero matter comes from,
and he knew. And it was like he knew it.
Yeah. He's been there. He knows that it's a dark, painful place. And then he blinks out of existence once again.
Probably the most exciting part of this whole thing is the preview of next week.
Well, okay, so yes. But I'll say the scene with Rose, you know, taking out those goons for me was the highlight of this episode. That for me was the highlight.
Same.
Yeah. And there were a lot of good things in this. We just all, I think, have a problem with the suspension of belief with Peggy's injury and her fall. But yeah, the preview for next week's episode.
Now, how many more have we got left to see?
I think three. Next week is...
No, there's nine total episodes.
Okay, so we've got four more, but next week is a double episode. So two episodes next week.
And I think the week after is going to be a double, because I looked on another site. Huh?
Would that be the finale?
Yeah, so I think we're going to get two episodes next week and two episodes the following week to wrap up the season.
Well, you know, we were talking about where is Dottie Underwood? What has happened with her? And I was thinking all along in this season, I don't know what it was, but there was something in the back of my mind that just said, you know, when you need to fight an unspeakable evil, you recruit an unspeakable evil.
Fight fire with fire.
Yeah, and Peggy is going to, and an injured Peggy Carter is going to recruit Dottie Underwood. And we're going to see her return, and we've seen some previews and pictures of and whatnot of Dottie and Jarvis working as a duo.
Whoa.
Yeah. So there's going to be some interesting stuff coming out of these next couple of episodes that really excite me. And I know they do you, Charles. You've been jonesing for Dottie's return.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. She's my favorite for sure. After Peggy, of course. I
mean, yeah. Sad. Well, I don't know if you guys read the news today, but Haley Atwell has been signed to another ABC show next season called... Confidential, I think it's called, and it's a drama, and there's some speculation that, you know, she won't be able to come back for season three. I don't know that they're actually planning a season three. Originally they weren't planning a season two. It was going to be, you know, eight episodes, one off, and it was such a big hit that they brought it back. I don't know if they're planning to bring it back for season three, but there are some things in this episode, and I think in the next couple of episodes, guys, that if Haley Atwell wasn't able to come back as Agent Carter, I don't know that it would be such a bad thing.
I disagree. I want to see my Agent Carter become the head of S.H.I.E.L.D.
But what, you couldn't call it Agent Carter anymore without Agent Carter.
Well, no, but you could call it something else.
I have a tendency to be on Johnny's side here on this, because... You know, if you think about it, you know, Agent Carter started out as total underdog. And you always like to root for underdogs. But at some point in time, it's going to be hard for them to keep her that way. I mean, she's already, you know, you could list all of her accomplishments and all of the people that she's defeated in terms of, like, one-upping them. So, you know, she won up the old chief. She's won up Jack Thompson. She's won up all the villains so far. And this is the first big major setback that's actually put her on her back that we don't even think she's maybe going to play a part in the next episode. And I wonder if they can really sustain that in a season three.
Yeah, well, and I, you know, I'm just saying, you know, we've been introduced to so many really solid characters that I really feel like a show could continue with those characters without Carter in the lead role. And we don't even know what the final fate of Wilkes is, and I'll tell you what my theory is. I think he is the Deus Ex Machina in the final confrontation. You know, he's immaterial, he's gone, but he reappears at the right moment and absorbs the power from Whitney Frost. That's what I think is going to happen, or he causes them to destroy each other or something of that effect. But if he survives, I think he survives as a very powerful character.
Yeah, and I don't know, as you were saying, you know, could they create another season of quote-unquote Agent Carter with the whole, you know, the way it's set up, or do they move to the S.H.I.E.L.D., the birth of S.H.I.E.L.D. and create a whole new set of characters around that, dovetailing into the, you know, the present day? I think we are seeing the last episodes of Peggy Atwell as Agent Carter.
Yeah. And
yeah, it's kind of sad, but I think it's been so rich in its performances and its visual aesthetics. The whole thing has just been terrific. And I don't know what else they could do. That's the point. They've done New York. They've done Hollywood. You know, they're running out of old cars and old planes and gadgets and you know. It's almost like James Bond is, you know, sometimes you feel some of the earlier James Bonds are the best because that was the first time they tried something and now everything's been being tried over and over again. And I think we're maybe getting that with these episodes.
You know what? That's fine as long as at the end we get to see Dum Dum Dugan show up one last time and get offered to be one of the first agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. As long as I get to see my Dum Dum Dugan, at least this season, I'll be happy.
Well, that may be a problem. Because the actor, I always forget his name, but he is under contract with another network right now. Yeah, they pulled him away, sadly. Anyway, well, guys, holy crap. We've been talking about this for an hour and 40 yeah. minutes.
And next week, and the next 2 weeks, we have two episodes. So how long are we going to...
Well,
we ought to bring us some rations and
yeah,
tents
so,
and sleeping
so
bags.
My suggestion next week is that we start early. Maybe
oh, yeah.
start at 7 instead of 8. And we'll have a lot to talk about. And look, guys listening... We have to skip over some stuff for time's sake, and we still spend a lot of time, but there's a lot of stuff that we weren't even able to touch on, and we'd love to get your comments. You can send us an email. Let us know what you think about Agent Carter and about this episode, The Atomic Job. You can send us email at feedback@dieselpoweredpodcast.com and let us know what you think. Post comments on our Facebook page, facebook.com/dieselpoweredpodcast, or follow us on Twitter @dieselpodcast. Let us know what you think. Let us know your theories about the next couple of episodes and your theories about Zero Matter, and convince Charles that he's wrong about this scene with Peggy getting impaled. Give us a clue. Throw us a lifeline here. Well, guys, any last comments before we head out?
I want to see the flamingo one more time.
Oh, that's yeah, my, we didn't have
Bernard,
a flamingo.
Bernard,
that's my one more
back
time
Bernard.
Moment.
It's actually Bernard who swoops in with Wilkes on its back and saves
yes.
the day.
Now,
a
that's an amazing
matter,
story.
A
fan artist,
madam,
you have your assignment.
Yeah, a Zero Matter... Flamingo Phoenix.
Absolutely.
Oh, that would be a great name for a band, wouldn't it?
Yeah, with wing-mounted gun turrets.
Yeah, the Flamingo Phoenix.
The real diesel punk version.
Okay, and if this is, Marvel, I know you're listening, if this is the final season of Agent Carter, then you will make another season of Agent Rhodes.
Yeah. Look, I want to see more of Agent Rose. I really, really do. That would be. I hope she stays as one of the central characters in the next couple of episodes.
Oh my God! I just realized who Rose is.
Who?
She is what's her name from The Walking Dead, who makes the cookies.
You know what? I don't watch The Walking Dead, so I don't know what you're talking about.
There is a character whose name for some reason is escaping me, who plays the whole, you know, kind of motherly a gentle cookie making a character, and is probably one of the scariest and most badass characters on the show.
Huh. Cool.
Yeah. All right. I probably would have had more effect if more people knew what I was talking about. But I know you listeners know what I'm talking about, and that's what I appreciate. Okay, goodbye.
All right. All right. Well, guys, if there's nothing else, we'll say goodnight. Going once, going twice, three times. On behalf of Ken Sharkey, Daisy O'Dare, and Charles Cornell, this is the artist also known as Big Daddy Cool, telling you to swing hard, swing often, and we'll catch you on the flip side.